Blog Talk Radio.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones. Call in and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time, yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up and shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
Well, welcome to Southern Sense here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your hostess with the mostest, the radio chick, along with my debonair, my sophisticated, my cool and intellectual co-host, Cool Mike. Good afternoon, Mikey.
Well, good afternoon. Good afternoon, everybody, on this tax day, April the 15th. I shouldn't be this jovial for that day, for that date, I should say. But great to have you here. Welcome, everyone, from Blog Talk Radio as well as Kinetic Hi-Fi. As Annie has introduced herself, I am Cool Mike from the beautiful, cold, snow-filled Grand Rapids, Michigan. We are ready to rock and roll on Southern Sense, and as always, we are glad you are here. Annie?
Yes, it seems like I got disconnected for some reason, and they're not letting me call back in. So I'm calling in on my landline, and it says the host is disconnected, but the show is going on.
When as they always say, the show must go on. And when in doubt with today's high-tech fashion, get on the horse and ride to your destination. If the automobile won't start, you know, or the plane isn't, the chopper isn't working, just take horse and buggy. So I'm really excited to have Mr. Faid back and his new book. Going to really get a little more educated as well as a lot more information regarding what we would refer to as Arab Spring. Opportunity lost? Oh.
Well, yeah, it is. The book is by Waleed Ferez, and it's called The Lost Spring. Let's get this correct. Waleed Ferez, The Lost Spring. And it looks like I can't get back in as a host. So if anyone sees that the host, waiting for the host to call in, the host has called in. Just can't sign in the host page. So this is going to be very, very interesting show, I should say. And actually, this is the second time this happened.
The good news is, Annie, I actually have some use of the board. I think it's Blog Talk because some of it obviously I cannot, but I do have for some, so I actually can play the music.
Well, let me see.
I think we just...
I don't know what the heck I'm supposed to be doing here, but...
Since Annie opened her mouth down there at that Beaufort County tax revolt party and went on television, I think powers that be are right outside her house. They keep unplugging and plugging it back in. So, I think we just lost Annie, but actually she will call back. Oh, there she is. Annie has returned.
Am I back in? I knew it. I was using the landline to call in, and now it disconnected the landline, and now I got back in as the host. I mean, this is really a messed up day.
Well,
messed
you
up
realize
day.
In West Virginia, they're listening to our show, and they're like, shit, she's back on. I thought I told you to make sure, and they'd be like, I'm sorry, boss.
Hey, and some intern
getting his booty hole reamed, courtesy of Annie and Ubelis. But anyway, great to be here, everyone, and just a quick reminder, we have plenty of good shows up and coming, but a special one that I have planned. We are going to have several of the women who are running for the Michigan House of Representatives. These are complete conservative women, all packing heat on their sidearm. So, you know something? Leave it to the women to straighten up all the shit that the men just don't have the backbone to take care of. Armed women to boot.
Well, that is absolutely true. Matter of fact, the women have been doing a lot lately. Matter of fact, we have now a new website up, the new line of 2016. I did that with my friend Gonzalez out of Bayshore Tea Party in New Jersey. Never met her. She just got in contact with me. So now we're up on Twitter, up on Facebook, all over the place, and we have a petition. Every Monday, a press release goes out, and anyone wants to see the press release, it's at norhino2016.webs.com, and they can take a look at it. And I believe this week we're allowing individuals to sign up onto the release, and you can sign up on there. Just go to norhino2016.webs.com, and as of this morning, there were 39 groups, and we've only been doing this for now, I believe this is the second week, and 39 groups have signed up. And this is our third press release that went out yesterday, so
Let's take a look at it.
Take
our country back one position at a time.
Right. Now, I mean, because of everything that got messed up with trying to get signed in this morning, we're running short of time and doing the dedication, so we'll roll the dedication over towards the last 15 minutes of the show. And we've got a lot to talk about, Mike. You know, this is Easter week. This is the Holy Week. And I think this is the perfect time to be talking on this subject.
Yesterday, of all things, I was at a town hall meeting with Justin Amash, our congressman. There's a lady there, and this was a big topic of discussion, was we are under an impression. Here's something that just to show you how dirty and disgusting the politics are. When we're talking about immigration reform, most of us are thinking about immigration to what? Mexicans, Spanish. This is being pushed heavily in the illegal Muslim community because they want what? Sharia law. And they want to start challenging our laws in this country. And that's one of the reasons they're pushing hard for this. And that's also... You got a microwave going on back there, girl? Keep hearing beep.
No, I'm trying to get something to turn off so it doesn't bother us, and it's not working. So, the heck with it. I said, it's one of those days.
Yeah, now there was a lady there at this town hall meeting who was on a hunger strike. She was surrounded by about 10 people, and supposedly it's 9 days. And they said, well, what do you think about, I can't remember her name, but Mrs. Jones or Person A, about her hunger strike? And Justin said something like, real nice pizza place right across the street you can go to. But they want them to sign immigration that says if you're here illegally, you're now a U.S. citizen, still not protect the borders. And she's on a hunger strike. So I pulled her aside and I said, She knew of me because of my name's been in the paper and stuff. I told her, I said, my advice to you, I said, get something to eat. I just walked away, I think. But anyway, this fits in line with our topic, is that an awful lot of illegal Muslims want to become citizens so they can actually challenge our laws. It's one of the reasons they're here. I mean, it's just another attempt at contempt of our Constitution.
Well, these are all things that Walid Perez's book,
We're losing you.
I swear there's a troll in my computer. Well, Mike, try to take over. Let me see if I can get myself back in.
Yeah.
I don't know what else to do.
Anyway, just try to jump back in. We'll cover the fort while Annie Ubelis is doing her deed. And actually, in the town hall, a lot of topics were discussed. Justin Amash talked about an awful lot of bills that have these really cool titles, the Building and Grounds Act, and really it's basically to violate your First Amendment. And there were some other bills he caught us up to speed on, one of which is, if you remember his NDAA, to defund the NDAA, that actually went down to defeat. But there's an awful lot of people bringing back a bill very similar. He also pointed out that House Speaker John Boehner rarely even votes, but he made it a point during this fight when his bill was on the floor about defunding the NDAA, he made it a point to vote. And, of course, he voted against it. Get for what you will. Today, the anniversary of the Boston Marathon. They did a couple of memorials, and one, as we speak, is taking place to honor what happened last year. The former mayor, Tom Menino, was there. And, Boston seems to have recovered. There's still some questionable activities, I feel, in regards to liberties, allowing SWAT teams to just storm into people's houses to just barge their door down as stormtroopers. But that's nor here nor there. I mean, it's great that the show must go on, and the show did go on. We all take our hits, and we all take our lumps and losses, and we somewhat move on. Another thing Justin Amash talked about was the budget, balancing the budget. One of the biggest challenges regarding the budget is that he says there's too much reaching across the aisle. He said he needs to reach across the aisle, but not in a compromising form where basically you're saying, okay, let's both agree on raising these tax. I get my increases, you get yours, we're all happy. He says you have to reach across the aisle in the exact opposite, where you come across and you say five things you need to cut, five things we need to cut, and hopefully you each end up cutting three or four.
Absolutely.
I think Annie
absolutely
is back.
Yeah, that's exactly what the No Rhino website is about. I want to let people know that we are up on teapartycommunity.com. They rebroadcast the show 1 hour after we end the show. So we end at 3:30. They start, I believe, at 4 to 5 or something like that. So you'll find us on teapartycommunity.com, Kinetic Hi-Fi out of Charleston also. So we're simultaneously broadcasting in Charleston at this moment. But this is what all the things that we were talking about, why we started this website, No Rhino 2016. And Justin Amash is the perfect candidate for that.
Yeah, he seems pretty good. I'm forcing him to endorse one of my candidates. And just to show you, Justin's a good guy. We all, from what you hear of him down there, Annie, but Justin's playing a little politics too. Here's a candidate in the race who will be joining us on our show, where Justin's a little hesitant about endorsing her. Her whole reason for being in the race is Justin Amash. He has left an impression and an influence on her to really get her, she's a cosmetologist. She does pretty well. But Justin Amash has energized her into joining, getting involved. And she's running against someone Justin endorsed 2 years ago, who is for Common Core, for Medicaid expansion, blah, 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 blah. But she's an establishment hack. So I said to him, I said, well, Justin, I've been with you since the inception. I'm going to start printing. You're endorsing her. You want to fight with me? That's fine. So I think we got our guest, but he said, like, no. He goes, I'm not going to fight with you, Mike. He says, I'll sit down with her. I said, that's something unacceptable. You're going to endorse her. And also,
all right. Well, Mike, I think we got our guest here now, so let me see what this is. Good afternoon,
right.
Area code 571. This is Southern Sense. I'm your host, Annie. Am I speaking to Dr. Waleed Ferez?
Yes, this is Waleed Ferez speaking. Thank you for having me today.
Oh, it is
my
pleasure.
Hey, doctor, welcome.
Thank you.
It is absolutely my pleasure. As a matter of fact, this is the third time you're back on our show, so I am deeply honored. But you have to bear with us. We've been having some technical difficulty, and the phone lines have been acting a little strange on us.
Okay. I am at your disposal. Anytime you want me, I could come back if you want. Or
No. We got you. We got you. We're not letting you go.
Okay.
Tell us about your new book.
Yes, indeed. I'm very glad to announce that I have a new book out. I started the campaign in New York at Fox News, then in Newsmax, and other media. The title is a good title. It's titled The Lost Spring, and the subtitle is U.S. Policy in the Middle East and Catastrophes to Avoid, which explains what the book is all about. A few years ago I came on your show and announced a previous book titled The Coming Revolution, which predicted the Arab Spring. So this one is going to predict where the Arab Spring is going to go.
Yeah, it really did, because after I read your book, the last one that you were on the show for, and watching the events, just every single thing you said was going to happen, happened. And you didn't say, well, it's going to happen on this date. You basically said, take a look in this area, and this is what's going to show up. And in The Lost Spring, you explain how the previous book, you saw all these things, and you tried to warn people. And you had a foundation that you actually went before your own foundation and said, hey, listen, this is out there. We've got to get the word out. And they were like, oh, no, you're just full of hot air. You know, you're just blowing it up the skirt. And you ended up quitting your own foundation because of that.
Well, before the foundation, my dear, I went to my publisher and I told them, look, I am going to title it The Coming Revolution. They said, are you sure, Dr. Ferez? This is a very risky. I said, it is indeed. And the reason was that I have been monitoring the region for the previous 25, 26 years. And of course, since 2009, I saw the change of trends in U.S. policy when President Obama went to Cairo, delivered a speech. Then he sent a letter to the Grand Ayatollah of Iran, Supreme Guide. So I knew that U.S. policy is changing and that the Islamists were organizing, but I also knew that civil societies in the region, because of Internet, Facebook, Yahoo, all that, were moving. So we had three dynamics, and I did my math equations, and by the summer of 2010, I've called the Arab Spring in the sense, of course, as you said, not the date or the particular event, but the trends. And I called three waves. Number one is that civil societies are going to rise. They will be disorganized, youth, women, minorities, Egypt, Tunisia, elsewhere. Two, that they're going to be a race. That was the most important warning I sent to Congress and to the administration, a race between the Islamists and jihadists and between the seculars, democracy forces. And three, whatever we're going to do or not do is going to impact on that race. And that's what we saw in Egypt with the Brotherhood coming to power in Tunisia, with the cousins of the Brotherhood, the Nahda forces coming to power. In Libya, the Islamist Salafi militias coming to at least part of power. And in Syria, a full-fledged civil war. So this book, The Lost Spring, is explaining how I warned, how the administration unfortunately did not project those events, did not side with the right people. So I am simply proposing to correct this policy, to salvage what we can salvage in the region. Otherwise, more catastrophes are going to hit us in the next few months and years.
Yeah, we can see that immediately, especially with what's going on with Iran. And just going through the newspapers, I picked up several different items, and automatically it flashed to exactly what you wrote in your book. And the first one was, Iran, this was on Sunday, rejected the naming of the UN envoy pick. In other words, they said, no, President Obama, you're going to have to accept the UN envoy, whether you like it or not. Matter of fact, they're initiating a lawsuit. They're looking for legal channels in which to force this envoy on us.
They are, and there is a reason behind that, because they feel they know that the administration has basically cut a deal with them and is not going backward. They've tested us in multiple places, including in Syria, including on Iran. We have, and this is something the public did not really understand over the past weeks and months, we have, the government, that is, transferred billions of dollars from Iranian frozen assets since 1979 to the Iranian regime. I mean, $1 billion, and it seems that the amount, the global amount, is going to be somewhere between $6 to $8 billion within the 6 months. We have lifted some of the sanctions. We have allowed businesses to go. So we sort of have helped this regime, hoping, and that's the Obama administration, hoping that they're going to change course. And as you just said, this was a symbolic gesture that not even on the ambassador they're making a concession. They're going to sue. But beyond that, beyond the ambassador, they said, and they continue to say, that they're going to continue with, and I quote, the build-up of strategic weaponry. So what would that mean? The missiles, all sorts of weapons, deploying more terrorists around the region. And if you ask the Arab moderates, don't ask us, here's in America, ask in the region, and they're telling you they feel very much threatened by the Iranian regime. So that is one of the catastrophes I'm warning about. If we don't change our policy towards the Iranian regime, it is going to be facing us with very serious menaces in the future.
Yeah, and you look at where Iran is. Their hands are now in Iraq. They're in Syria. Mm-hmm. They are now also making moves and advances against the Saudis.
Yeah.
Everywhere. They've put themselves everywhere. And it's something I believe people are not paying attention to, but it is extremely frightening. You know, and the other thing I picked up in the same paper, but this was on the front page, what no one really knows about was this Iranian-American. He was a U.S. Marine born here in the United States, and he was convicted of spying for the CIA. Now they've resentenced him, and now he's sentenced to 10 years. Mm-hmm. And he has a chance to get out, I believe this September, October, something like that, because I think there's something like if you serve one-third of your sentence, you can be released early, but it's a conditional release. And he's going to be used as a bargaining chip, along with, I think there's two other Americans that are being held in Iranian prisons. They're bargaining chips.
They are. There is also the American Iranian pastor who has been arrested. Then also you have a former FBI officer and many Iranian American, Iranian Canadian, other citizens from the West arrested in custody in Iran. Some of them, there was a woman from Canada who was a journalist who died in custody. And that's only the foreigners, the foreign citizens, but the citizens of Iran, and that's very important to focus on it so our public understand, are living under terror, are living under oppression and suppression. We all remember that in June of 2009, there was a major uprising in Iran, something we have been waiting for the previous three decades. 1.5 to 2 million Iranians were demonstrating in the streets of Tehran. This was triggered because of the, you know, the elections, the fake elections that were done in Iran. But reality was that they were calling for the collapse of the regime. 60%, and I made those statements in this book, 60% of the demonstrators or so were under the age of 20. That is the future of Iran. And a large segment of those 60% were girls and women and young women. So we were very close. Had we stood by this demonstration, because that's a demonstration that's worth supporting, we would have most likely shook off the foundation of that Iranian regime. Unfortunately, what did the administration do? What did the president do? They were very badly advised, and they said, oh, we're not meddling in this. And, of course, the Iranian regime understood this as, this is a green light. Nobody's going to intervene. They crushed the revolution. And that was a probably the gravest mistake in our U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East so far.
I would say it was a version of Tiananmen Square.
It was. If you compare the pictures, Tiananmen Square was in Tiananmen Square, and there were hundreds, maybe a few thousands. There were 2 million for many, many, many days. And yes, indeed, it was a version, but it was a very bloody version, because as a result of that, while Chinese, more or less, you know, are suppressed in terms of freedoms, but they're moving towards the middle class. Here, Iran is a hell for the middle class. Its economic situation is very bad for the people, not for the regime. You know, when they talk about sanctions on Iran, who's getting the sanctions? The people, the citizens. But the regime is very much sealed off. They have their own banks, they have their own cash, they have their own villas. They're living very well, like the Soviet leadership during the Cold War.
Yeah, Doc, I have a question, kind of shifting gears. Just last year, Okay, and it's good to have you back. I always like having a fellow Lebanese guy on the show. What was the truth, what was going on in Syria? We finally saw the president coming out and doing interviews. He used chemical weapons. No, he didn't. Who's winning the war? Where is that situation right now? Is it a stalemate? What's going on in Syria? Because now we don't hear anything about it because we're not involved in it, but we are sending them money. What's going on?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right to ask the question. This is the worst place on earth now as we speak. It's not Egypt or Iraq or Iran. The worst place as a drama, as a human drama, is in Syria every day. Hundreds and thousands of women and children and elderly and adults, civilians and, of course, combatants are killed. We're talking about somewhere between 120,000 and 135,000 people who have been killed in the last 3 years. And yet we have also adopted sometimes wrong policies and sometimes no policies. And I'll take advantage of this answer to just say, historically speaking, we could have. In 2011, the United States and the coalition forces were still in Iraq. So we have separated between the Iranian regime and the Assad regime by our mere deployment in Iraq. Al-Qaeda was not yet in Syria. Hezbollah was not yet heavily involved in Syria during those 9 months of 2011. And there were a lot of demonstrations. So it was an ideal situation for us to do something about. We did not. By the time, you know, 2011 ended and we had to withdraw from Iraq because of domestic considerations here. So now, as of 12 and 13, the Iranians came through Iraq and they have connected with Assad. Everything has changed. And, of course, Al-Qaeda came to fight them. Hezbollah moved to fight Al-Qaeda, and you don't see any more of those demonstrations of civil society. You only see civilians killed and eliminated. Now, back to your question about the chemical weapons. Well, we don't know exactly what happened. What we know is that chemical weapons were used, mostly by the regime, but probably also by the other side. But regardless, this is a breach of international law. And look what the administration has done. We have warned that this is a red line. You cross it, and we will come, we in the international community. They did cross it. We ordered our battleships to get ready, at least to strike on those weapons. And out of the blue, overnight, we stopped and we asked the Russians to find a solution. Now, this means that the regime understood that we do not follow, you know, our words with acts. Second, it became all over the region a perception that the United States is not serious anymore. And I would go to the point of saying that what's happening in Crimea and Ukraine, look how far I'm going, is also an indirect result of our misstep in Syria. Because we proved that we're not going to go and be serious about any of our statement, then the Iranians don't take us seriously, the Russians don't take us seriously, and the jihadists, of course, have never taken us seriously.
All right, well, it looks like we got a caller coming in. Let me bring this individual in on the line. Area code 410, you're on the air live with Southern Sense. Our guest is Dr. Waleed Perez. Who am I speaking to?
Oh, hey, you got moving on the line, moving forward. How are you? And I'm enjoying the show, enjoying hearing from the doctor and enjoying the dialogue. What an interesting topic tonight. So.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, if you want to ask a question, just raise your hand and we'll bring you in.
Okay, I would like to ask a question tonight, basically about the what's going to happen to the Christians, both with the Sunni and the Shia sects in Syria and Egypt and other places, and you know, what's the way ahead? I would like to ask that question.
If I may, that's a very important question. Actually, I'm dealing with it all the time, and there are a couple chapters in the book which are an update on the situation of the Christian communities in the Middle East, communities or minorities. This is one of their worst stages now in history. Beginning by Egypt, we have seen over the past few years that the Brotherhood in general, but also the jihadists and other militias have been attacking the Christian cults. How many? 72 churches and educational Christian establishments have been burned. Many Coptic girls and young men have been killed. So Egypt is a battlefield whereby the jihadi element is going after the Christian cops as a revenge because of the change that took place last June by civil society in Egypt against the jihadists. But more dangerous
is the situation in Syria. In Syria, we have been witnessing a systematic ethnic cleansing against the Christians, and we have on YouTube a unfortunate, very large number of evidence of how individual Christians and families have been butchered and killed by the extreme elements of the jihadists. This is also having an impact on Iraq, where the Christians have also been put under persecution. And, of course, in Lebanon, we know the history of Lebanon, whereby the Christians politically are being suppressed. So across the region, we have now, we are witnessing an era which is an era very negative for the presence of the Christians. And yet we don't see internationally a policy that would focus on what to do exactly to make sure to protect those more victimized communities than any other in the Middle East.
Yeah, because we're also seeing this in Nigeria, too, the uprisings now. So
yes, certainly in Nigeria.
Mali, Somalia.
Yes, am I on?
Yes, you are.
I'm also very concerned about what's going on in my own country, in the United States of America, about the policies against Christians that's happening in our own governments. For example, Christians not being able to express their views and being persecuted and censored and sometimes sued and having judicial actions taken against them. People are actually losing their jobs for expressing their Christian views, and they're losing their insurance, and they're getting investigated with their taxes and all kinds of stuff. And those are things that are actually happening. And I'm concerned not only about what's happening, to be fair to all the populations in, Egypt and Syria and across the Middle East, to be fair, in my own country, the same things are happening here. And there's not a lot going on in the defense of Christianity, and I'm very concerned about that. So wanted to call in with that perspective. And I just hope that, things will get better and, people will recognize that Jesus Christ is real. So just wanted to say
what,
that.
What seems, and what you said, Flyover, I think is, I'll throw this to the doctor, it seems like in all the political rhetoric, we are overlooking the fact that Christians are they're the people being mangled and killed. I mean, they're the real victims.
Well, I guess my point is that if we're not willing to stand up for Christianity in our own country, how the heck are we going to be able to do that across the world? And the only one claiming to do that is that Putin guy in Russia. And that's really, scratching my head on that one. So
yeah. Doc?
Well, Doctor, you want to take that?
Well, yes, I hear what the gentleman has said. It's in the debate almost every day. We hear it on Fox News panels all the time. I mean, my little modest contribution in this big debate about the future of Christianity worldwide is, of course, focused on the Middle East. And let me add one point that has to do with our domestic politics. Middle Eastern Christian communities here in the United States over the past many years, and I'm just focusing on that specific group I'm having an expertise on.
Well, God bless you, Doctor. I support your views.
Well, thank you. They have been blocked from expressing their views. Let me add one thing that maybe the public doesn't know, in addition to the larger problem. But the Middle East Christians, Coptic, Maronite, Syriac, Assyrians, here in this country, in Detroit, in Chicago, in New Jersey, in Florida, in Washington, in California, have been blocked by whom? By the Muslim Brotherhood lobby in this country. They were professors, they were intellectuals, they were bloggers who have been attacked and criticized and called Islamophobe, for the simple reason that they were raising the issue of persecution in the Middle East. So now if you are in this country and you want to raise the issue of persecution in another country, in Egypt or elsewhere, there is a lobby here in this country that would treat you of bigot and Islamophobe. And this is part of the political strength of the Islamist lobby. So that's the little light I wanted to shed on that part of the problem.
Yes,
wow.
But when you in your book, you write about the targets of Islamophobia, specifically here in the United States, and you said the first one, the Muslim Brotherhood, I'm trying to read this now really speed fast, so going after the writers, the theologians, the religious societies. Mm. The second group, looking at the historians. And then the third groups were the ones that actually formulated the policies to counter terrorism. And we see this over and over again because they've gone after us in the newspaper. They have gone after us in the courts. Now they go and they infiltrate our own government. And they're training the CIA, the FBI, the law enforcement, NSA, DHA, whatever, every single alphabet soup agency out there.
This is a very important subject. Actually, it's going to explode because a lot of information now is coming from the region. That's really ironic. But those who rose against the Brotherhood in Egypt and those who are pushing against them, even among Arab moderates, are now making public statements saying that there is a lobby by the Brotherhood in the United States. Look how odd and how ironic at the end of the day that they are the ones who are warning us about them. But let me say a couple points about this Islamophobia phenomenon. While it is true that you may be a xenophobe, and that exists in all groups if you are, you know, anti-anything, and that is not the right thing. Morally, it's wrong. But Islamophobia per se has been created by this lobby to target three groups, as you just mentioned. I mean, in a open democracy, you could have theological debates. You may like the theological debates or not. I don't do theological debates. But there is a freedom to do it, and that has nothing to do with politics or with national security. And the lobby goes after anybody who does theological debate. Two, historians. I mean, academics, professors at universities who dare, quote-unquote, talking about the caliphate in the Middle East, things that in the Middle East we talk about every day, have been accused of Islamophobe. But the more dangerous for our national security is that a number of instructors, of analysts, of advisors to the bureaucracies, to government, to agencies, have been pushed out of their jobs because they were helping the U.S. government determine and detect the jihadists. At a time, we had a Major Hassan massacre in Fort Hood. We had a Boston attack. We had maybe 70 attempts, including the Fort Dix 6 and others. So while we need experts to tell us about the jihadi ideology, which is a political phenomenon, you see that the lobby pushes back against them. And that debate is going to widen and widen. It's not going to go.
All right, we got another caller coming in.
I'm going to jump off. Thanks for taking my call, and you know, God bless America and our republic.
Thank you very much, Movie. All right, Skype caller, you're on the air live with Dr. Waleed Perez. You're listening to Southern Sense. I'm your host, Annie. Who am I speaking to? Skype caller.
Hello.
Yes,
can
Skype
you hear
caller,
me?
You're on the air live. Yes.
Okay, great. Hi, this is Thinking Conservatively. Actually, I'm not on Skype. That's why I was a little thrown off there. I'm still learning on this. Yeah, I was kind of curious about a couple of things. The first one being you were talking about how Christians are being treated over there. And I guess one of my concerns is are these groups aware of how serious the situation is? I mean, yes, of course, they'll know from watching the news and things, but they are vulnerable, it seems, and are they being trained or taught how to get out is my first question. Do they have a place of refuge in the event that this should explode? The other question it has to do with in terms of whether or not they're even able to evangelize at this point with this movement to silence them. How effective are they, I guess I'm saying?
Thank you for these questions. I'll begin by saying let's first focus on the mere existence of these communities, and then we'll talk about their freedom, basic freedoms, including freedom of evangelization or communication or, you know, theological debate. That is really the dessert at the very end. But they are targeted not because what they're trying to spread. They are targeted as communities per se. I mean, in Egypt, for example, churches have been attacked on and on again. And the same has been the case in Syria and in Iraq. And, there were many Christian leaders executed in Iran. So the first question, do they have ways to leave, or can they defend themselves, or do they have more secure areas? It really goes from country to country. In Iran, there is no such enclave for Christians. They are dispersed, and they are, you know, targeted, and they're very weak, and they are at the mercy of the regime. Now, some will tell you, well, there are many Christians in Tehran who live well. Yeah, they live well because they let go of their rights. When you let go of your political rights, then the Islamist regime would tell the world, look, we have our little Christians here, and they live fine. Yeah, but they have no rights anymore, no spiritual, political, etc. In Iraq, that's different. You have an enclave in the north. You have a whole area in the north, in the Kurdish areas, known as the Nineveh Valley, where you know, the Assyria, old Assyria was. And they are seeking a autonomy, an autonomous province. So that is something that many Christians in Iraq are looking forward to go to. In Syria, it's very difficult because half of them are in the south around Damascus, and the other half is in the northeast and in the northwest. And because there is a war, it's very difficult for these communities. There will be briefings in Congress, that I know of, that will try to determine how to extend economic and other help. It's not just to the Christian, but to any civil society targeted by the extremists. In Lebanon, it's a different story. Christians have a large areas where they live. The problem there is political representation. So if you go country by country, you would determine that the most difficult situation actually is of the Christians in Iran, then Syria, then Egypt and Iraq, and, of course, Lebanon at the end. And I'm not even touching Sudan. Sudan is a different issue where the Christians have been massacred for many years, since the 80s.
Which is something that we are not being told prime time. It's something that we tend to find out either through our individual churches or coming on the internet. Our news stations are not telling us about this, which makes it even more dangerous for our people over there.
Yeah, this subject has not been considered by, quote, the mainstream media as a matter of emergency, of urgency. I remember when I was born and raised in Beirut, Lebanon, and I came here 24, 25 years ago. When I came to America, I was surprised to see that the entire genocide against the black Christians of Sudan didn't make, you know, the front pages here, and that what was happening around the region in terms of persecution of minorities, and there are other minorities, not just Christians, the Kurds at the time.
Absolutely.
I remember that the Kurds and the Berbers and the blacks of Eastern Sudan and Western Sudan, all of this persecution was non-existing. Everything we spoke about, I remember in the 90s, was the Arab-Israeli conflict. I mean, as if there was nothing else in the Middle East except the Arab-Israeli conflict, which is important and need to be addressed. But I remember when I watched CNN and they would flash Middle East crisis, I would say, hey, we're going to talk about 10 other issues. It's Middle East crisis meant only Israel and the Arabs, period.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's funny because going through the newspaper again, just this is today's paper, buried in the back, like the second to last page, was the article on the blast in Nigeria.
Yeah.
And just vaguely they allude to the Boko Haram terrorists targeting schools, churches. They throw mosques in because they only go after, you know, one sect versus another,
mm-hmm.
the villages, government facilities. And they're saying killing thousands in a five-year period. Don't you think this should be something on page one?
It should be on page one.
Not in the back of the paper?
Of course. It should be on CNN. It should be on the major mainstream. It should be in editorials in the Washington Post and the New York Times. That's precisely what my book covers. In the Lost Spring, I explain that the academic elite of this country, which has produced most of the media elites, and I call it the classroom, produce graduates to the newsroom, to the courtroom, to the war room. Our educational system, in its essence, has been poorly educated and informed about these issues. And therefore, when a graduate goes to a desk at the New York Times or C-SPAN or NPR, little they know about these issues.
And if I might expand on that, when you start talking about how inexperienced these people are, this will be my last point because I know you want to go on, but you talk about the inexperience of these people who are moving into journalism and writing, then you hear on the news how President Obama turns around and actually brings in movie stars and celebrities in order to be ambassadors of these countries, only to find out they can barely speak the language, much less tell you where it's at on a map. It's almost like America has been dumbed down in order for the rest of the world to ridicule. Yes, but thank you very much. I'm going to let you go, but thank you very much for answering my question.
Well, thank you for coming.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's amazing the difference in the tactics. You compare President Bush's tactics and then President Obama. Here we were set on a certain path. It seemed like we were succeeding. It seemed like we were able to show our strength. And now we do a 180, and I'm trying to understand what his purpose is, and the only thing I can see is just the destruction of America.
Well, there's a lot of debate about that. There's even a couple of movies and a lot of controversial issues on this issue. But let me say one thing from my little corner here. The foreign policy of the administration, with regard to the greater Middle East, if you go over the map, and your listeners can just have a map and look at these countries one by one, and you see that our policy has led to, if not disasters in some cases, but major, major crises. Look, Libya. Libya, we stood by the so-called rebels, quote-unquote. We did not distinguish between the good guys and the bad guys. We ended up having a Libya that is divided. One-third of it is under the control of jihadi militias. One of these militias attacked our embassy in September of 2012. That's the reason for there is no debate about Benghazi, because one of these militias was part of the group that we have supported in general against Gaddafi. In Egypt, it's even a greater political disaster. We stood by the Muslim Brotherhood. The United States, a liberal democracy, stood by the Muslim Brotherhood. Versus whom? Versus the young, secular women, youth, Christian Copts, moderates, until a point where the Egyptian population said, enough. They rose last June, and now the Egyptians are correcting their own revolution or their own upheaval. And in Syria, I just mentioned how bad the situation is. And, of course, on top of that, you have the Iranian situation. Now, what needs to be done is for Washington to have a massive change of foreign policy, because at the end of the book, I'm positive. I say, okay, even under this administration, if you want to have better results, you need to change. Now, if they don't change, then mathematically speaking, we're going towards more difficult situation. And I add one point in that book. Even if there were going to be another administration from a different point of view in 2016 or 2017, with what's been done right now, it's going to be very difficult for the next administration or the next Congress to correct or to address those huge problems.
You mentioned one thing about, you know, the different rebels. That is the major fault of this administration. And it's not just our administration. It's also the Europeans, too. They're not differentiating who these rebels are. And because of the Muslim Brotherhood now, they were able to infiltrate a lot of these rebel groups. What once were secular, what once were liberal-thinking individuals that didn't want Sharia law or an Islamic, I'm trying to think of the proper word, Islamic based government.
Thank you. If I may say, I mean, something very simple that's covered as well in the book, there is a reason for why U.S. policy has been what it has been till now. It's who is advising. The elite that is advising our foreign policy, basically, is influenced by, wants to partner with the Islamists in the region. And we're not talking about just Islamists being around. We're talking about regular academics and intellectuals who have made a massive mistake of analysis, thinking that the Brotherhood are reformers, thinking that Nahda and Tunisia are sort of, you know, democracy group, while reality on the ground, people in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, and Syria have been urging the administration, stop this partnership with these dark ages forces and then work with civil society. Unfortunately, we dumped the civil society, and then we moved with the Islamists. And that's what we've done also with the Iran. We dumped the opposition in Iran in June of 2009, and we were trying to cut a deal, which we did now with the Iranian regime. And by the way, this deal is not going to produce what we want, because the Iranian regime is using this deal to assert what they want. So So that's why I continue to warn in the book and hope that at some point in time, Washington will wake up and begin a massive reform of its own foreign policy and national security policy.
Well, one thing you wrote about in the book, but you never really named it, you wrote about how the promises were made on one hand, and then when we expect them to be fulfilled, we find that they go in the opposite direction. They absolutely lie. And you don't name it as the method of doing taqiyya. I was just curious why you never directly said that.
Well, look, I was probably the first English-speaking author who in the 90s exposed taqiyya as a political tool, as a political weapon. That's in the early 1990s. And it has been used, and many, many authors after that wrote many books and many pieces on it. Of course, I have written about taqiyya in Arabic before, prior to 1990, out of the Middle East. I am trying to put most of the book in a political framework, and I'm not doing a theological debate. The theological debate deserves a book by itself, and there are projects now to have a collection of authors who would tackle these issues from an ideological slash theological perspective. I wanted to stay away from the theological debate so I could focus only or mostly on the national security perspective to be understood by a larger segment of the population. And then, of course, there will be future works that would connect both.
All right. Well, you mentioned a few moments ago, I'm not going to let it slip past, that Egypt is starting to correct itself. And I noticed, you know, they kicked the Muslim Brotherhood out of the government. What drove me absolutely mad, I mean, screaming at the TV, ready to throw my shoe through the screen, was watching Lindsey Graham and John McCain telling the Egyptian government that just got rid of Morsi that they must work with the Muslim Brotherhood, allow them back into government, release them from prison. And when you said that they're starting to self-correct, I caught this article that a court in Egypt sentenced an ultra-conservative Islamist who was an ally of Morsi to a year in prison for insulting the judiciary during his trial. They're starting to clamp down on these Islamists.
Yeah, they are. I mean, they are the serious move against the Islamists in terms of dismantling their terrorist networks, fighting the jihadists in the Sinai. And then you have the whole, I don't want to call it chaos, but troubled time between the removal of the Muslim Brotherhood and the election of two institutions. One would be the president, so they have a hierarchy that is elected, and then a parliament. And I have argued even on Egyptian TV that maybe the election of a president is going to be very important for Egyptians, but the election of a parliament after the Brotherhood is going to be actually, in my view, the beginning of the real Arab Spring, because that is going to be a parliament that is going to have multiple political parties. It may not be as sophisticated as the European Parliament, as Congress, but it's going to go in that direction. Multiple political parties, and they're going to hold hearings, and they're going to tell the public, both in Egypt and in the international community, that the Brotherhood, at the end of the day, are a network of radicals, and some of whom, of these radicals, have been implicated in terrorism. So what is going to happen, that's why I have argued that Egypt is going to correct itself, not overnight, nothing is done overnight, but they are going to go on a direction which is going to get them to go back as an Egypt that is pluralist, democratic. And let me add one point. In the Sinai, you can see that the Egyptian army now is doing the fights that we and NATO have been doing in Afghanistan against Al-Qaeda. And you can see that the Egyptian government has been pushing back against Hamas. The Egyptians have told Hamas, we know what you've done. We know that you've supported the Brotherhood, and we know that you have been training people against us. So expect a lot of surprises in the region.
Well, how do you think Egypt would then deal with Iran?
Iran is not the priority of Egypt, but I can see if Egypt gets back to where it should be, and Egypt is going to draw with it other moderate Arab countries, to the surprise of many here, who, by the way, are putting the Brotherhood on their terror list. There's a major revolution happening there. You have the United Arab Emirates, you have Bahrain, the Saudis, of course, who in the past realized that all their funding and donation that they have been sending for
religious perspective have been actually managed by the Brotherhood. The Brotherhood were the ones who were radicalizing everything, Jordan as well. This is a group of Arab moderates which is going to rise along with Egypt and then go against the Brotherhood or go against Al-Qaeda, and at a specific time, they're going to start to contain the Iranians. So they're doing their job while we are withdrawing and retreating and cutting deals with the Iranians. It's unseen of.
Yeah, because when you were pointing out in the book about our retreat and withdrawal, it made me sit back and think. And then you wrote this one sentence that you said that, I don't have the actual quote in front of me, but I just scribbled some notes, that the U.S. executed the greatest retreat from supporting freedom since World War One. World War One, we were complete isolationists. Are
yeah,
we heading back on that point?
That, what I meant by then, two things. You're right. Number one, that the Wilson 14 principles of self-determination and human rights and freedom, and then it was followed by a massive withdrawal and isolationism. And here we had, in the years that followed 9/11, those declarations about freedom forward under the Bush administration, and then this administration that is executing a massive retreat from the world. So there's some sort of almost at a century, close comparison, the same phenomenon. The problem has been that under the Bush administration, while the narrative, while the statements and the presidential speeches were in the right direction, the bureaucracy did not follow through. The bureaucracy of the Bush administration, I argue in my book, most of it, not all of it, of course, dealing with these issues, has already been influenced by, by lobbies and by people who wanted to open up to Iran and those who wanted to work with the Brotherhood, the lower bureaucracy. Now, that bureaucracy is the administration of today. So you see that the change now tells me that the policy is very serious in the administration. It needs really a push by the public and a push by Congress to see perhaps a hope for a change by the administration.
Oh, from your lips to God's ears. You know, it is very, very... I'm trying to say the word, but I'm going to stumble over it. It's very special, the fact that you're appearing here on this show on Easter week.
Yes.
And
yes,
I think that it's just wonderful that Dorothy scheduled you for this time, and I thank her for that. I want to ask you another question. How does the petrodollars fit into all of this?
Petrodollars is the essence of all of this. Let's explain what the petrodollars are. Over the past 30 years, I would say even as of the late 70s, mostly 80s and 90s, a number of oil-producing regimes in the region, for a variety of reasons, have sent a lot of money in donations to the United States to be invested in universities and on campuses to defend the notion of either the Arab culture or Islamic culture or what have you. That's in general. But those who actually managed these donations were mostly from the Muslim Brotherhood or Islamist or Salafist or even close to the Iranian regime later. So the petrodollar investment in the United States did not really target, medical faculty, did not target the space research. They mostly targeted Middle Eastern studies, meaning those branches in political science, international relations, and politics that explains to the American students and public what is the region. So when you see these millions of dollars going to Harvard and Georgetown and dozens of universities targeting the classroom, deciding on what will be taught and what won't be taught. I'll give you an example. What would be taught, Arab-Israeli conflict. What won't be taught, the rights of women in Saudi Arabia or the genocide in Sudan. So no wonder why years later the vast majority of American graduates and students had no idea that outside the Arab-Israeli conflict, there are another 10 to 12 other conflicts and injustices. So it's only when the Arab Spring exploded that most Americans said, oh, really? This was happening? Slavery in Sudan, the Kurds being persecuted, the Iranian youth not happy with the regime. So this has played, the petrodollar influence has played a tremendous role in impacting how American youth and then adults would think for many years.
It has. I'm sorry, someone was interrupting me. I'm sorry, just destroyed my train of thought there for a moment. Wanted to ask the lobbyists, along with these petrodollars, how they've been influencing not just the administration, but other movements through using CARE, as you said, in the schools and so forth?
Well, CARE, it's not a secret anymore. I had members of the U.S. Congress from both parties, by the way. That's very important. It's a bipartisan position, including, of course, in 2011 when the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee in the House of Representatives, Senator Schumer, other members of Congress have said clearly that CARE represents an extreme view. And other experts have claimed that CARE is a front to the Muslim Brotherhood. Some even mentioned Hamas. So having said that, and I'll leave the actual expert in CARE dealing with the issue, but this is a lobby, quote-unquote, in the sense of a pressure group that went after every single expert, every single scholar who was trying to raise the issue of injustice to minorities in the Middle East or injustice to civil societies in the Middle East, other than how CARE wanted. I mean, CARE played the role of the Muslim Brotherhood lobby in the United States, and this is something that is not going to go away. They used lawfare. They used smearing. I was attacked by CARE viciously in March of 2011 when I was not invited to testify, considered as an expert to the Homeland Security Committee to talk about jihadism. So CARE attacked me because they didn't want me to educate the American public about what is the ideology of the jihadists. Of course, the committee then did not dismiss CARE because I continued to brief them. And then the biggest attack by CARE against me, just to give you a few examples, was when Governor Romney in 2012 announced their foreign policy advisors, and they named me as one of the advisors of national security and foreign policy. CARE waged the mother of all offensives against me, calling me names, inventing stuff, claiming that in Lebanon I must have been some sort of monster, or just to make sure that the campaign would drop me. Did not. So CARE is a political organization. This is not a civil rights movement. It doesn't care about the communities in the Middle East, and I'm very responsible for what I'm saying right now. There is no referendum. There is no election. Nobody appointed that group to speak on behalf of a majority of Muslim Americans. Actually, a majority of Muslim Americans is opposed to what CARE is talking about because they know that CARE is the Muslim Brotherhood. In the same way, a majority of Egyptians, 33 million marched in Egypt against the Brotherhood, there is a majority of American Muslims. But here, we don't have a way to determine if an organization actually formally represents or not because there are no elections of communities. Here we elect in our districts, we elect our representatives, our congressmen. We don't elect CARE as representative of the community in this country.
What's funny is that when CARE burst on the scene, I think it was, 20 years ago, so I don't know the exact time.
20 years, exactly. 20 years today.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, 1994. And guess what? Let me just mention one thing you reminded me of. The president of CARE, who has been personally attacking me letter after letter, I was with him on a panel. He may have forgotten that. And with my own ear, I heard him saying, I support Hamas. There's a video online that says that. So I knew it 20 years ago that this movement, this group, at the end of the day, is a front for the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, 20 years ago, you say Muslim Brotherhood, and everyone's going, what are you doing talking about terrorism? Because we knew Muslim Brotherhood was a terrorist organization, plain and simple. But once CARE made themselves a foothold here in the United States and they grabbed everyone's ears from big business all the way up to the White House, suddenly the Muslim Brotherhood is one of the nicest organizations possibly to work with. And it was all propaganda.
Look, what CARE has done is textbook propaganda activity. On the one hand, the lobby, the petrodollar lobby on campuses, would diseducate, this is non-educate, those who are going to become the opinion makers. And on the other hand, CARE will approach them once they are opinion makers to give them a wrong version of the events. So this is a pincer movement. But now let me go to the good news, is that the counter to this propaganda activity is not just going to come from the United States. Now more and more and more Americans, because of the work of bloggers, because of the work of radio free shows, because of all this alternative media that, by the way, CARE is very concerned about. They keep attacking
the haters, quote unquote, online. I mean, you know, the haters, if you say that CARE is a Muslim Brotherhood, meaning you become a hater, this is a political reality. But this is not going to come only from the States. What's happening is that there is a revolt in the region, in the Arab world, against the Brotherhood. And the tidal wave of information is coming from the region to the West, to the United States, and Americans are going to be very, very surprised.
Well, I hope so. I honestly hope so. Our biggest problem is that when we talk about the Middle East, everyone assumes everyone over there is Islamic. And this is where your book really opens up everyone's eyes to let people know that there are these people that are secular. There are these people that are Christian and the Kurdish. They're intellectuals, liberals, and so on and so forth, that want nothing to do with an Islamic society.
They want nothing to do with the extremists who are Salafist, Islamist, jihadists. Those are very active minorities. They are very strong, like the National Socialists began by being a minority in Germany or the fascists in Italy. But then just by giving the example to our listeners, and they could go on YouTube and see 33 million Egyptians, and 90% of these are just regular Egyptians who happen to be Muslim moderate, rose against the Brotherhood. That is a major change that is happening in the Middle East. And we're going to see it in Iran, and we're going to see it elsewhere as well.
Well, I hope so. I hope that we're going to have a second Arab Spring going across the region like a tsunami. We've got another caller coming in. Let me bring this individual in on the air. Skype caller, you're on the air live with Southern Sense. I'm your host, Annie, and our guest is Dr. Waleed Ferez. Who am I speaking to?
I'm sorry, it's thinking conservatively again. There's just so many questions, and I really apologize. I promise this will be the last time. You were speaking about CARE, and I do know about them. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship of that organization, the IHRC, and the United Nations? Because it seems like over the years, since the Human Rights Commission was revised, from what Eleanor Roosevelt had been doing. Since that particular revision, it seems like the Human Rights Commission in the UN has been just changing into a more and more threatening place for discussions and negotiations. And I know that the Islamic Human Rights Commission was supposed to have had consultory status with the UN. Is there any connection between the IHRC, CARE, and the UN at all, or has that been put off to the side?
Look, I wouldn't want to begin a mass discussion of details of the issues, because there are many experts very good in that subject. There is the United Nations Watch and many other NGOs. But let me say one thing. Over the past many decades, the International Organization of the Muslim Brotherhood seized any opportunity, both on national scales and at the international level, including at the UN level, including at the UN Human Rights Council, to lobby against those minorities and those persecuted, including Muslims in the Middle East, who would go to the Council of Human Rights and protest the regimes or protest the oppression. And we've seen it in Geneva, we've seen it in the United Nations here. But my point is that now that the Brotherhood has been exposed in Egypt, that's where the mothership is, I think that there's going to be a change in behavior. I just saw yesterday on Egyptian TV that there are Egyptian NGOs. This is good news, because these are Muslim moderate Egyptian NGOs who are going to go to Europe, who are going to go to the international community and to Asia and actually expose what the Brotherhood has been trying to do, meaning radicalize. The Brotherhood has been working on using those religious differences for their own interest, on increasing and deepening the animosity, if animosity existed at all, between those groups. So yes, your question is very valid, and I think there are very good expertise and details about it and available online.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When you were talking about NGOs, you're talking about non-government organizations, right?
Indeed, yes. NGO is a non-government organization, and INGO is an international non-government organization.
Now, I want to remind everyone that where they can get your book, they can get it at the LawSpring.net. I'm having a blonde moment today, I think, I swear. The show started off with all the technical difficulties, and once you get off on the wrong foot, you keep on tripping over yourself. But it's thelostspring.net, or they can go to your website, waleedferez.com, correct?
Absolutely. If they want a signed copy, then they will go to thelostspring.net and make that demand, or waleedferez.com, W-A-L-I-D, Ferris, P-H-A-R-E-S.com. If they want a quick copy, they could go to Amazon.com, and at the next opportunity, they could, you know, if they see me in one of these events, I'll be very happy to sign. And by the way, I would like really to thank you for the opportunity that you gave me today and have given me in the past, and for the great work you're doing in advancing the debate about freedom.
No, I actually thank you, because you opened my eyes a number of years ago, and we've had our conversations, and this book is, I say, a must-have for every single American to read. It's an excellent read, very, very well written, and explains everything in such detail that I'm hoping that you're right, that we do have a second chance here with the second Arab Spring, and let's just hope we don't miss this opportunity.
Let's always work with hope and on our minds. Thank you again for your welcoming.
Oh, definitely. And you're welcome back anytime. Just have Dorothy give me a call again, and I'll be very, very happy to have you back on in a heartbeat.
I will be back. That's a promise.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Ferez.
Both of you.
Cool Mike, you still with me? Did I lose my co-host? I think I may have lost my co-host. I think he fell asleep. Well, this is Dr. Waleed Ferez's book. Again, you can get it at thelostspring.net or at www.waleedferez.com. There's a link up on our show page. And if I can find now my dedication, we can go forward with that. So I'm looking through all my notes here. And cool, Mike, where did you go? Of course, I would have to lose my co-host just at this moment. So what else could go wrong? But I want to thank everyone that's up in the chat room. And thinking conservatively, you're supposed to be having a show coming up soon. So if you do have a link for that, put that up there. Ken, I see you there too. Put your link up there in the chat room. Feel free to put it up there. I want to say hi to Bigfoot and Freedom and Moving Forward. And Moving Forward, thank you for your phone calls. And Thinking Conservatively, thank you also. They were great questions. Now, everyone knows that we normally do start the show off with a dedication to a fallen hero. But things got a little bass-ackwards today, as my friend Mike Cutler likes to say. So today's dedication is going to be going out to four of our heroes. They were killed when enemy forces attacked their unit in Zahiri District in Afghanistan on October 6, 2013, during Operation Enduring Freedom. CID Army Sergeant Joseph M. Peters, Army Nurse First Lieutenant Jennifer M. Monroe, Army Ranger Sergeant Patrick C. Hawkins, and PFC Cody J. Patterson, also an Army Ranger. So today's dedication goes out to these four heroes. And this is from the Military Times. Four soldiers died in a roadside bomb attack by Joe Gould. Two Army Rangers, a nurse and an Army criminal investigator, were killed by a roadside blast in Zahiri, Afghanistan on Sunday, October 6th. One of the Rangers was killed while trying to aid a fallen comrade. The criminal investigator killed was the first agent of Criminal Investigation Command to die in Iraq or Afghanistan, though agents often assist Special Operation Forces. First Lieutenant Jennifer M. Monroe, 25, of San Diego, California, a nurse assigned to Madigan Army Medical Center, Joint Base Lewis McChord, Washington. She was an Army Special Operations Command Cultural Support Team. Sergeant Patrick C. Hawkins, 25, of Carlisle, Pennsylvania, assigned to Company B, 3rd Battalion, 75th Ranger Regiment, Fort Benning, Georgia. Sergeant Joseph M. Peters, 24, of Springfield, Missouri, a special agent assigned to the 5th Military Police Battalion, Venezia, Italy. Private First Class Cody J. Patterson, 24, of Oregon, assigned to Company B, 3rd Battalion, 75th Ranger Regiment at Fort Benning, Georgia. Colonel Christopher S. Vanek, commander of the 75th Ranger Regiment, called Hawkins a man of character and commitment and said Patterson had a limitless future. Hawkins was moving to the aid of a fallen comrade when he was killed. Colonel Patrick J. Ellis, commander of the 3rd Battalion, said in a statement. Sergeant Patrick Hawkins was a brave and incredibly talented Ranger, he said. His actions that night were in keeping with the epitome of the Ranger Creed. Quote, I will never leave a fallen comrade, unquote. Our thoughts and prayers are with the Hawkins family during this difficult time. Hawkins had turned 25 days before he was killed and was on his 4th deployment. He served as a rifleman, gun team leader, and a Ranger team leader with Company B. His awards and decorations include the Ranger tab, the Combat Infantry Badge, the Parachutist Badge, the U.S. Army Expert Rifle Marksmanship Qualification Badge. He was posthumously awarded the Bronze Star Medal, Meritorious Service Medal, and the Purple Heart. He survived by his parents and wife. His father, retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Roy Hawkins, told the Patriot News that he and his wife never expected their son, Patrick, would join the Army. But Hawkins followed in the footsteps of his father, who retired from the Army War College after 30 years in service in 2008, and his parents supported him in the decision. He got sort of motivated to join the service. It was sort of a surprise, Roy told the news. Of course, we supported Patrick in his decision. Private First Class Cody Patterson was the poster child for the Ranger Regiment, Ellis said of the rifleman who was killed on his 2nd deployment to Afghanistan. He was courageous and dedicated and lost his life while fighting tenaciously against our nation's enemies alongside his fellow Rangers. Our thoughts and prayers are with the Patterson family. Patterson's awards and decorations include the Parachutist Badge and the Army Expert Rifle Marksmanship Qualification Badge. He was posthumously awarded the Bronze Star Medal, the Meritorious Service Medal, and Purple Heart. He is survived by his parents and his sister, all in Plumeth, Oregon. A Facebook page was established to support the family. It notes that Peters was expected to leave Afghanistan in 2 weeks. Today, October 6th, is an amazing mama. Amazing mama was told her husband was killed in action, just 2 weeks before he was scheduled to come home, the site says. We ask you to join us in remembering her husband, a hero, and help raise funds to help Ashley and her son, Gabriel, just get by day to day, whether to be for food bills, anything to help with any financial burden that may arise after such a tragic loss. First Lieutenant Jennifer M. Marino. Marino, who was on her first deployment, commissioned into the Army as a nurse. She went on to complete the Army Airborne course in 2009 and served in a medical surgical unit at Madigan before she volunteered to serve with Special Operations Cultural Support Team and deployed in June. Such teams are typically comprised of female soldiers who can engage Afghan women. We've lost a superb officer and a caring nurse who served with marked distinction and honor throughout her career, Madigan Army Medical Commander Colonel Ramona Fiorli. She was a talented member of our team who lost her life while serving her country in one of the most dangerous environments in the world. Her bravery and self-sacrifice were in keeping with the highest traditions of the 75th Ranger Regiment. She was making a difference in Afghanistan, and that legacy will live on. The Marino family is in our thoughts and prayers. Marino was posthumously awarded the Combat Action Badge, the Bronze Star Medal, the Meritorious Service Medal, the Purple Heart, the Afghanistan Campaign Medal, and the NATO Medal. She previously held the Parachutist Badge. She is survived by her mother and two sisters in San Diego and her brother, who is also serving in the Army. California Governor Jerry Brown and his wife said Marino bravely gave her life in service to our state and nation and expressed their deepest condolences to her family and friends at this difficult time. Brown ordered the flags to be flown at half-staff at the Capitol in Sacramento in our honor. Sergeant Joseph M. Peters was on his 3rd deployment. The 2 previous deployments were to Iraq. Peters completed courses in protection services, human intelligence collection, crime scene investigation, and analysis and interrogator cooperation. CID spokesman Chris Gray said the agent's specialized training and capabilities, such as evidence collection, have proven to be invaluable to special operation forces. That's why our agent was with this team, Gray said. I have to tell you, working with these men and women for many years now, CID agents are very aware and accept the fact that they are in an inherently dangerous profession, whether conducting a murder investigation in the U.S. or supporting combat operations overseas, Gray said. They are passionate about their profession and are truly dedicated heroes. Major General David Quantock, the Army's Provost Marshal and Commander of Army Criminal Investigation Command, called Peters a highly respected agent and a soldier who sacrificed his life in the defense of this nation. We're extremely proud of his service and what he accomplished as a CID special agent and as a soldier, Quantock said. His death is a reminder to all of us of the unequaled contributions our military members and their families make on a daily basis in the defense of freedoms that we all enjoy and value so dearly. He was posthumously awarded the Combat Action Badge, the Bronze Star Medal, and Purple Heart. Peters is survived by his wife and 20-month-old son. We dedicate this show to these four brave heroes, to all men and women who have served, who are serving, and who will serve, whether it be in the military or as first responders in the fire department, emergency services, or law enforcement. We dedicate this song, My Name is America, by Todd Allen Turner. God bless them all.
Born in the grip of oppression, I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. When I'm attacked, I protect and defend, because my name is America. I stand proud and free. My name is America. Don't tread on me. I cannot be broken. I cannot be. Others gave it to me. They believe in the virtues I stand for, my respect for humanity. Now I'm challenged by tyrants who envy my power, but their vicious deeds become my finest hour. Because my name, I rise.
name is America. And is my co-host back with me? Cool Mike, you back with
me here?
Yeah.
I just had to take a call, so I had to mute the phone real quick. So I'm back.
All right. That was a great, great interview with Dr. Perez. And I'm just
sure was.
Frustrated because everything just possibly could go wrong, went wrong with this show, including Yanni shoving a note in front of my face. And he did it on a piece of paper with a ton of writing on it. And he puts the note all the way on the very bottom, like, I'm supposed to know what the heck he's trying to tell me. And I was like, geez, get out of my way. Don't make me lose my train of thought. Get out of here. Oh, man. It's just one of those shows. And I don't know if anyone heard kittens mewing in the background on their end. If anyone did.
I didn't.
It's my, they were walking around my feet crying and crying and crying. And the two of them, Imp and Mittens, being absolute imps, demanding attention, going, oh, I hope these mews are not going over the air. That would sound so unprofessional. I actually reached into my garbage can next to me, pulled out a piece of paper, wadded it up, and threw it into the hall to make them go chase it and get out of the office.
Well, I assumed it worked.
Well, I've got the main instigator, Mighty Mite, right now sleeping quietly and so angelically behind me. So I guess she put her babies to sleep. Oh, I swear. There's always something. Always something has to go on, right?
They don't understand that, you know, they're interrupting the show yet. as always, I really liked the doctor, we should actually call him professor because he is obviously a historian on this. I like his know-how of the detail. We see the stories, we watch him on TV, we see this is going on, that's going on. He obviously has the story behind the story, and that's so important that we really know the details of the details.
Right, and he himself being a Maronite Christian Catholic, and he grew up right smack in the middle of that all that revolution, if anyone remembers it back in the 70s, how horrendous that was. And God bless him. I mean, he's got 10 great books, 10 books out there. And this last one, I'm telling you, every single patriotic American should read this book because he really lays it out on the line, showing where we screwed up and how we screwed up and how we can get ourselves back online. And he predicted everything that's going on right now. And he's just a fantastic guest and just a wonderful person. So,
Well, it certainly is, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Well, we're down to our final 2 minutes, and we will be back Friday. We're actually going to be rebroadcasting a show because it's Good Friday, and it should be a day that I intend to spend in the honor of our Lord Christ, and I will be at church and we'll be rebroadcasting. We'll be rebroadcasting one of our favorite episodes with Mikhail Nissan talking about manipulism. And then we'll be back after Easter. And if I don't see anyone or hear from anyone between now and then, I want to wish everyone a very happy Easter. And my friend Barbara Gonzalez from the Bayshore Tea Party, who is my co-conspirator in this No Rhino 2016, we will be doing a show on No Rhinos. And we'll do it for 2014 and 2016. So, again, check out the website, norhinos2016.webs.com. Also, check out Dr. Waleed Ferez's book at thelostspring.net or waleedferez.com. So I want to thank everyone for listening to the show, and have a happy and healthy until we meet again. I say good night, and God bless to you all.
Good afternoon, everybody.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble.
You've been listening to Southern Sense Blog Talk Radio. Producer and your hostess extraordinaire is Ann Ubelis. The theme music, American Stand Up, is written and performed by Don Fortney. For more from Don, check out his webpage, teapartymusic.webs.com. Southern Sense the proud member of Ghost Fighter Radio and Freedom Media Network. Southern sense is common sense. Take it out, Don.
Americans.